Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with bonkers.ie, Ireland's favourite comparison and switching website. Visit bonkers.ie today and start saving on your household bills.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And just a reminder before we start that tomorrow we are in the Faith Egg House Hotel just outside Waterford City for the Bank Holiday Friday, Funny Friday. All are welcome. Loads of prizes, giveaways, etc., etc. But all are welcome. The usual Funny Friday crew. And as always, it is absolutely and totally free. Faith Egg House Hotel outside Waterford City tomorrow. Let us begin today's phone calls. And we've been contacted by PJ English. We're talking about gun crime. When was this gun produced? And aimed at your daughter, PJ.
Good afternoon, Joe. It was last Sunday.
Okay.
She was travelling from Drogheda down to Ashbourne. Mm-hmm. And about 3 o'clock, she noticed the car coming against her.
In the broad daylight, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
In the afternoon. Okay. Yeah, and she noticed the car coming against her, and he was waving, as she thought, his hand mm-hmm. out the window. And she thought it might be warning her of Garda checkpoint or speed check or whatever. But just as close as she got to the car, she saw him pointing a gun at her. And
What type of gun, PJ, did she say?
She didn't know. She was so nervous when she saw this thing happening.
You can imagine, yeah, okay.
But she saw a gun, a lookalike gun, a mm-hmm. gun anyway. And so he pointed the gun at her and he fired a shot. And
wow.
Luckily, it was pellets, not bullets. And do you know what the biggest concern was? If the window of the passenger or the driver's window was open, and if dim pellets came in and hit her in the eye or anything, it could have caused a big disaster.
And even the fright of seeing somebody for no reason, not that there would be any reason, but somebody out of the blue pointing, overtaking you and pointing a gun out, was it out of the driver's side, so to speak?
Yeah, no, the traffic, the car was coming against her.
Oh, coming against her, okay. So it was the passenger side.
Yes.
And he pops down the window and takes his hand, she sees a gun aimed at her, he pops off the gun, and luckily for her it was a pellet gun, but luckily she composed herself and didn't panic when she saw the gun, PJ.
Well, what she did, she said, was she held on to the steering wheel for all her worth, she just ducked her head down, and then she heard the pellets hitting the windscreen, and she just pulled in, and she just let it rip. She cried for half an hour, and then she telephoned us, and you know, we're down here in South Tip, so we couldn't go up to her. But
so this was on the Drogheda to Ashbourne Road. Do you know which direction the gunman's car was coming from?
He was probably coming from the Drogheda side.
Okay. And your daughter was going in the other direction.
Into Ashbourne, yeah. It was about, what she said, about a 5-minute walk from Ashbourne.
As we discovered, talking to people who've been held up at gunpoint over the last few days, you can remember very little because you go into such shock. Does she remember the make of the car?
She said she remembered nothing. She didn't know how many people were in the car. She didn't know the colour of it. And kind of, she was saying if she had gone to the guards, and she didn't remember anything. What's the point? Do you know what I mean?
And she didn't remember. She just felt she'd be... Well, the only thing is, if the guard, you say, hang on, there was something else on that road that day, it might add up. But anyway, hopefully the guards will be listening down to hear about it. Last Sunday afternoon, around 3.30, Ashbourne to Drogheda Road. And she doesn't even remember what age he might have been.
She just saw this fella and he was waving his hand, and do you know the usual, someone might be kind of warning of maybe a crash or of a speed checkpoint, and she just kind of slowed down and next thing she saw the gun being pointed at her.
And the pellets that were discharged from the gun, did they make any impression on the car?
It hit the windscreen, but they kind of hopped off of it. Do you know what the reason I rang in about is because I heard, do you know, it's happening in Dublin City, and could there be, could the two things be connected?
These pellet guns,
but he was driving along, and just fired the shots at her. But if her window was open and if she had got hit with him, she could have got into the wall or into oncoming traffic or whatever. Do you know? So I think it is very frightening, the roads. Do you know, what have we to watch out for when we're driving on these roads now? Do you know?
OK, stay there for a sec, PJ.
Yep.
Bart, good afternoon. You know what it's like to be held up with a sawn-off shotgun.
Sawn-off shotgun, Joe. I do indeed. That's a long time ago, but you never, never, ever forget it.
Well, tell us about it, because we heard that yesterday from a woman who'd been a victim of a kidnapping.
Well, I was working in a bookmaker shop in Stony Bather.
In Dublin, yeah.
Yeah, in the mid-80s, I suppose. And this Grand National Day, which would be the busiest day that time in a betting shop, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was there, I was marking the board. You know the way at that time they used to mark the prices on the board, and I was marking away. And this fella came in, and he just put a shotgun under my chin, and he said, if you move, I'll shoot you. You know what I mean? And another fellow went in behind the counter, took the money, and it was all over in 2 seconds. But like, you can't, you go numb. My legs were like jelly. And like, even now to this day, if someone walks behind me on the road, I'll walk across the road to the far side road. You know, you'll never, never, ever forget it. You know what I mean? It's just a absolute, totally frightening experience.
And what were they covered? Their faces covered? Or
no. They were caught after. They were a well-known gang. I don't know whether I can name them or not, but they were a well-known gang. And
were they convicted?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, then tell us what gang they were in.
They were the Little John gang, they were called that time, but then they turned out to Factory John, and you know who the other John was, who went on to be afterwards.
John Gilligan, yeah, Factory John is John Gilligan.
But there were six or seven of them in the gang.
And he is small stature, yeah.
Yeah, the nickname down that time was Little John.
Yeah, you know, he's a small man.
He had about six or seven fellas going with him. I'm sure they were all over the place in a few seconds, you know what I mean? And like, but like, it's an awful experience. No one understands it. Like, you just go, like, you'd want to kick him and do something with him, you know, because I was a young fella at the time, you know. You'd want to kick him, but you wouldn't be able to kick him, you know what I mean? You know?
What, you just couldn't do it? It was like that poor woman that was held up at gunpoint outside the Guinness storehouse there on Monday evening. People who saw the footage. Your man, the gunman, was obviously demanding money on the phones, but she couldn't. She was so upset.
She couldn't coordinate herself to open the handbag. You couldn't move. Fella said to me, why didn't you kick him in the, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was actually up, as you know, that time the board marker was up high. I was up off the floor, like, you know what I mean? But you wouldn't, because you're not able to move, like, you know, and you're afraid. You're afraid of your life, like, that it'll shoot you, you know what I mean? Because the previous week I'd shot a guy in blowing off the ear of a guy down in Queen Street in a betting shop, you know what I mean? So you know, and I knew the man like quite well, like that I was done, you know.
How much did they rob, by the way?
I think it was around 36,000 at the time, but they never got the money.
Wow,
they got
in 1982?
Yeah, that would have been a Grand National Day that time.
36 you know, grand, was, that's, I'm looking it up here, that's over 100 grand in today's rate.
You take that, Joe, that time. There was no such thing as computer betting or anything like that. Everyone came and they queued from 9 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't get paid on the Saturday, they got paid on the Monday. You know, so the money would be, they know exactly, the money would be in the till then, they see, because the money would be there to the Monday to pay out again. You understand me? You know?
So that was Stony Batter back in 1982. Now, Stony Batter today is completely different. It's full of vegan restaurants and chickpeas.
You had Paul Street at that time, which was really, really a no-go area. Like, they all ran into the tenement houses in Paul Street. They were able to escape in there and they couldn't be caught because there
was... Paul
Street, no longer existing now, right? You know when you go down the corner of Queen Street?
Yeah, of course I do.
Well, there on the right-hand side was a street called Paul Street, right?
And where's it gone? The street is gone.
The street's completely gone, yeah. The street's completely gone.
Never heard of that, okay.
Yeah. You know, that's gone. That street has gone.
And you say that was up around there
before the redevelopment came, like, there was nothing there. Like, they were, some of the tenement houses there at the time were unoccupied because they were shifting most of the tenants that time up to the Navan Road. Remember all the old people's houses they built on the Navan Road?
Yeah.
They were shifting them up there, so there were some of the tenement houses and they had. Right fun, they could escape there from anything, from robbing there and get in there and hold on. You couldn't find it, you understand me?
And had you ever had the bookies been, as the fella said, robbed before?
Robbed, they came down to the roof before that to rob it. Took the safe, but that there was no one there. They came down the night time, took the safe out of the shop, like, they took the safe through the shop. That was the way they used to rob places before the shotgun came in, you know what I mean?
And you think Paul Street is gone?
I think it's gone.
Are you sure?
I mean, this is redeveloped now. I haven't been there in the last. I haven't been in Dublin.
Okay, no, it doesn't. Okay, you just went around there in those days.
Yeah, well, possibly.
That'd be opposite the King's Inns, wouldn't it? Would it be?
Oh, no, it'd be up further. It'd be up right opposite. Possibly right opposite the junction of Stony Batter and Queen Street.
Ah, yeah.
Not King Street.
Oh, yeah, fair play.
You know, just when you turn down, used to a couple of little shops down the right hand side as you turn down North King Street.
Yeah, I'm looking at Google Maps here, and so is Laura Lee. I can see a cul-de-sac called Paul Street just between Blackhall Place and Blackhall Parade. Anyway, it's a cul-de-sac. But anyway, just it's only
But
the shop was raided before.
Was read it twice or three times before. But actually, the man that owned it in my time, he sold it and got rid of it, you know, because he couldn't.
And how would you survive? How would a bookie survive a 36 grand cash hit?
The man didn't survive. The man didn't survive.
Oh,
like,
did he?
You know, he couldn't.
Shut down the bookies.
Shut down. Well, they sold the bookies, like, to get to pay their debts, like, you know what I mean?
But, okay, you mentioned John Gilligan's gang there, Factory John, Little John. Who else? Any other run-in?
I had a different circumstance. I opened a business then in Rathmines myself. I was in the window business. It was construction and windows, right?
Okay.
And I was working for a lot of Garda. As you know, there's a big Garda station at Mines there, and I was working right at the back of it, and the lads would come in and they'd be wanting two windows for the house or something like that, and I used to do that for them, you know. And of course, as he was called in those days, he was called Greaseball over there, like, you know, but known as Martin Cal. But he came along anyway, and he cut the tires of every car that was in the laneway at the back of Rathmines. Mm-hmm. He cut all the cars, and mine was one of them.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, Jesus, this is not right. Like, I'm working to make a living. I can't afford this. So,
and was the general doing that to get at? He thought they were all Garda cars.
He thought they were all Garda. Okay. No, he didn't. He knew my car wasn't a Garda car because I had my name on the side of it.
He just wanted to annoy everybody.
He wants to annoy everybody. Anyone that was working for guards couldn't work for guards. So I went down to his house. I knocked at his door and he opened the door. And like, if anyone know him, his hair was as oily as. Really oily.
It was kind of stuck to his head. Like, yeah.
And he said to me, what are you looking for? I said, look, you cut the tires off my car. And I said, if you want windows in your house, I'll supply them to you just the same as I supplied them to the guard. And he pushed me. I said, get out, I'll sort you out, you know. Yeah. But the next morning, I went into work and there was a scruffy brown envelope under the door and £80 in it.
So he paid you?
I don't know whether he paid me, but someone paid me.
So you got you're one of the few people...
Yeah.
That got the better of the general.
From that day, I was 15 years in Rathmines. I was actually even there the day we shot, and I never had any more hassle. He never came into that lane after that.
Okay, but still, as you say, you still remember the trauma. Maria Donoghue, Maria, good afternoon. 51551 Joe at rte.ie. Maria, it was your parents.
Hi, how are you?
Hiya. Well, when did it happen?
About 3 years ago, my mum and dad are elderly. They were in their 80s, and... they woke up to a balaclaved young man at the end of their bed waving a knife at them.
Oh, my God.
They lived on their own at the time, threatening all sorts, and he wanted money.
Okay.
So after a long procedure upstairs, he didn't get what he wanted, and he forced the two of them downstairs into the kitchen. And he made all sorts of threats to him and everything. And my mother, ironically, had heard on a Joe Duffy show about you have to give them something. So she went to her emergency cash box and gave him some cash, but he wasn't satisfied with that. So he kept it up in the kitchen and he went through everything in the house. So the whole ordeal went on for nearly an hour and a half.
Wow.
And my mother then was trying to keep it together because she thought my father was going to slip away because he had a pacemaker. So she just kind of toughened up and she said to him, look, you've just got to do what you've got to do, and that man's going to have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I need to look after him because she already has her of sons anyway herself.
Fair play to her. Yeah.
So, she had her holy candle lighting. Granny has the candle lighting. And anyway, after another long ordeal, he eventually left and he threatened them that if they contacted the guards or anything, he'd come back and he'd finish them off. So for another half an hour, they actually sat there on their own before they started contacting any of us. And then obviously all the family legged it over to where they live on the Cork Road in Waterford. It was absolutely horrific. But that was the start of my father's demise then. He was well. He was at my daughter's communion. He was great. And then he just became housebound, chairbound, bedbound, and we lost him then. And ironically, it's actually his birthday today. It would have been his birthday today. But,
and what age would he have been?
He'd be in his 90s now. He was in his late 80s. But the neighbours were incredible. The guards did call several times, but they said they didn't have enough forensic evidence to charge him.
Even though your mum was in the house for nearly 2 hours?
Oh, God, yeah. Sure, he held a teacup in his hand. He did all sorts. But Waterford is pretty tough now these days. There's a lot of that antisocial behaviour and a lot of drug problems around the town. And we were actually up in Dublin not 4 years ago, so it's a big change. It's a nice town, but they have a lot of problems with that side of things. But we lost him after that, and then we've seen to it that my mother hasn't ever been left on her own pretty much day or night, because there's a few of us living around the town now, and someone stays with her every night. But you see, people don't realise the consequences of afterwards. The robbery is over, but then you're left with this massive fear.
And was your man ever caught, Maria?
They said they'd catch him for other break-ins. My mother had a very good description of him. He was young. He was high as a kite. He had the balaclava over the head, the knife. He kept saying he needed money for his boss, the criminals. He couldn't pay him back and all sorts of rubbish, you know. So I'll never forget it. For my mother's sake and my father's sake. And it changes you.
How was your mother, by the way?
Well, today we were out in the hospital. She fell and broke her shoulder. She has a 4-week kidney infection, and she was out for physio today. She's very, very, she has an incredible faith. Yeah. Like, we don't know, you know, our generation don't know faith. Like, they know faith, you know, but a strong woman. But, like, I often think of Brendan O'Carroll. She's love, if he's listening, she's absolutely love Mrs. Brown's Boys with my father. And they have a load of sons. And I was saying, someday I must write into him. And if he was ever passing through, get him to call into her. Because he'd make her day. The laughs we had watching that. They were good people, you know. They brought us up to do right and work hard.
And did you say to me, by the by there, Maria, that your mother had buried another son?
No. They buried their first baby many years ago. Not at all, no.
Your father was badly affected, traumatized.
Oh, that was the end of my father. My father never slept a night after that. He really became fearful. He'd start ringing the care doc during the night. We wouldn't know. We could have care doc out twice, three times during the week. He was just so scared. And he'd often, if he got an infection, he'd start going a bit delirious about the man is at the end of the bed with a knife. And the doctors are going, what? And we'd know. He was a very resilient man. He was in the army. He moved to England. Mm. He moved to New Zealand. He was the foreman of a shipping company in Ross Company. That's why we moved to Waterford way back in the 70s. But he didn't deserve the end he got, you know. I'll never forget it. But he was some man. Yeah. So that's it. Sad.
Okay.
Sad.
Yeah, yes. You know. Who's that? Bart. Yes, Bart.
You know, this PJ here.
Yeah, PJ. Sure. Sorry, PJ. Yeah. Whose daughter was shot at on Sunday. Yeah.
Yes, it's just that all the other issues there were for gain. Do you know, there was nothing to gain out of firing a gun at my daughter's car.
That's true. Just fear, yeah.
Nothing to gain, just pure thuggery. Do you know,
Money. Money was at the back of it for drugs in our case. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
but they never forget the damage to do, though, Joe, afterwards. They don't. No one sees the damage to do.
No. It's a post-traumatic. That's the new word for it. I don't know what the old word for it was, but it's that trauma. Is massive. You know, but luckily, my parents had a fantastic community. There's only 20 houses on that street. They're there nearly 50 years. And the neighbours were just upstanding, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, kind regards to your mother, especially on this day, but also
Mary
especially...
Mary is her name. Mary, she's a great woman.
Kind regards to Barry. And if she wants to go, if she can, go to see Brendan O'Carroll, the musical, Mrs. Brown's Boys, the musical at Christmas, let us know and we'll organise that for her. If she wants to come
up in Dublin. Of course we would. That'd be brilliant.
And she'd get to meet him as well if she wants. Yeah. Okay, he's in the point, as I call it, the three arena in December. Yeah,
can we, the top of the Lewis.
If she wants to come up, she can. With a few people. Okay, aww. Maria, thanks indeed.
Thank you.
Kind regards to your mother on this day. 51551 Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
On joe.rt.ie and 51551. And I mentioned yesterday that I heard one commentator saying about the incident which was first reported in Liveline at 1:45 on Tuesday, that incident at 6:15 the previous night outside a Guinness storehouse where two, if not more, Italian tourists were held up by two men, one of them wielding a gun. And the commentator said, well, if they had been Irish, they would have known it wasn't a real gun because muggers don't use real guns in Dublin, which is news to me. But anyway, Pat O'Leary. Pat, good afternoon. You are a gun expert.
Oh, Jesus, Joe. Good afternoon.
Okay.
That's the last thing I'd describe myself as, but okay. I'm 65 years of age and I've been shooting since I was 17, so I know a little bit about guns.
Well, you sure do. Okay, well, tell us. Saying it's hard to tell the difference these days.
A few things that happened recently. First of all, because of my age and because of my interest in guns, there's a particular pistol that I'd give my right arm to own, and it's a Colt M1911.
Okay.
Anybody who's into firearms will know the one I'm talking about. My wife and I have been to several different open markets, you know, the ones that are on a Saturday and
Sunday. Sunday, yeah.
And they sell secondhand tools and God knows what else.
Yeah.
And I went to a stand at the one down in Inch here in Wexford, and what did I see on the counter? He was selling all sorts of imitation or replica weapons. What did I see? A Colt 1911 in a box. Mm-hmm. So I asked the guy, wow, can I pick that up? He said, yeah. And it was obvious from the word go to me, because of my knowledge of firearms, it was obvious it was a toy. One of them was the weight. Number two, there's a little red sleeve that screws into the muzzle. It's a dead giveaway. And I said, what I'm looking for is something more realistic. I have to stress a few things before I go on. I'm not looking for something to raid a bank with. I'm in the biggest shooting club in the country. And that's all I'm interested in, is hunting and target shooting.
But are you allowed to have handguns in Ireland in shooting clubs?
Yes.
In shooting clubs?
Yes.
Are you?
Yeah, strictly in a shooting club, Joe, under no other conditions.
Mm-hmm.
A rifle or a shotgun, you can have it for hunting. Like, I have a rifle that I use for deer hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I have a shotgun that I use for clay pigeon shooting and rabbit or pigeon shooting. But a pistol, no. It's strictly and not just any club. The club has to be approved by the Gardaí. So, and every 3 years you fill in a 9-page form, application form, to renew your license. It's that strict. Mm. And as I stressed to your researcher there recently, the day that changes, or if I got wind that it was going to become a little bit easier, it's no longer my sport. I'm not interested.
And what do you use handguns for in a gun club?
Target shooting.
Okay.
Target practice, that's all. There's huge competitions worldwide with these things, and it's purely competitive stuff, Joe.
And the market, where was the market where you saw this superior replica for sale?
The one that we were at was down in Inch.
Near
Gorey. You know
it yourself. Very busy one, yeah, of course I do.
Very, very busy one. So anyway, I said to your man, no, I'm not interested. That's obviously a toy. And he produced a box, opened it up, and my eyes popped out of my head nearly. My mouth fell open. The last time I saw one as realistic as that, it was the real thing, and I used it. I picked it up out of the box, same weight, same colour, same everything. The only thing that gave it away that it was an imitation one was when I pulled the slide back on the top. That's the part of the gun that slides back to throw out the empty case. Pull that back. So yeah, it's obvious that's an imitation.
Why, how do you... The slide of it or the glide of it or the...
The slide. It's called a slide. It's when you discharge the pistol, the top part, it's like a track, comes back and throws out the empty case and slides forward and puts the next round into the breech. So it was obvious...
Now, was me man trying to sell this as a real... he wasn't trying to sell it as a real...
No.
He was... So they're perfectly legal.
This is the thing that I'm trying to get.
Okay.
that I'm trying to get both to the people, the poor people who have had these bloody things pointed at them, and more importantly, what I'm trying to get at is the guards here. How in the name of God can you sell a thing like that? Now, I have to stress, Joe, I'm not suggesting that anybody who's had one of these things pointed at them laugh at the people and say, ah, go away out of that, will you? That's only a toy. Never. If you point a gun at me, it's a real gun.
Yeah, but is it not? I just go back to the handguns and the gun clubs.
Yes.
After
yes.
I thought after Dunblane, that horrific tragedy in Scotland where that lunatic killed, what, nearly 20 children, if not more, in 1996. I thought they banned handguns in the UK.
This isn't the UK, this is Ireland.
Oh, I know that, sorry. Well, so you said...
That's another subject, though, for God's sake. Joe, for God's sake, don't get me going on that subject. No, they've really, really tightened up. Really tightened up.
Are they tighter than here?
In England?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a total ban on what we call sidearms in England. Sidearms are pistols or revolvers.
So can you have a gun club in England doing what you're doing? I know you're doing lots of other things and... Could I have an M1119 Colt M1119 in a gun club in England?
No. All revolvers and pistols are banned in England. All.
Yeah.
Over here, I can get what they did was, by way of tightening it up a little bit over here.
Yeah.
You can get any pistol as long as you're in a club, and it's no more than .22 caliber. They put a ban on any caliber above .22.
Okay.
Now, I don't know why they did that, because like, you can kill someone with a .22 as easily as you can kill them with a .45. Okay.
And what do you think of that argument? By the way, Dunblane, there were 16 children and their teacher killed before Thomas Hamilton turned the gun on himself.
Yeah.
And then they did ban the handguns. So, like, why don't we just copy and paste the UK legislation like we normally do?
But what's that going to achieve, Joe?
Well,
it's never happened, though. You see, the difficulty that I have with that, Joe, is that a legitimate shooting person like me has a difficulty with that, you know, because, I mean, let's face it, Joe, if I want to kill a number of people and I can't get a gun, there's 101 other ways of doing it.
Now, what do you think of people who say, well, if they were from Dublin, they would have known it was a dummy gun. Well, by the way, we don't know if it was a dummy gun at this stage.
No. And I want to stress yet again, Joe, it's not a dummy gun if it's pointed at you. That's the end of it. There's no arguing about it.
Yeah, it's not a banana, like.
No, it's not a banana.
Yeah, okay.
It's black.
And the legislation says it is a gun. Don't they? If you're brandishing it as a gun, threatening people as a gun, okay. Let me bring in Mary Mac. Stay there, Pat. Pat's in Wexford.
Sure.
Mary McMahon. Mary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You're in Maynooth. What happened?
I'm in Maynooth, yeah. What? I was held up with a hatchet. I worked in the bank.
Yeah.
And two guys rushed in.
Mm-hmm.
I was on one counter deposits. The cashiers were at the other end. A guy with a sawn-off shotgun scaled the counter where the cashiers were.
Yeah.
The fellow with the hatchet jumped over my counter, and a big intake of breath. A hatchet you're not used to. I went under the counter where your feet are.
Right.
Because you get used to guns, looking at them on telly.
Right.
But never, a hatchet kind of denotes decapitation.
Okay, and your man, did your man say anything to you, Mary, with the hatchet?
Where the F is the safe?
Okay.
Now, and he had his hand aloft, holding the hatchet, but he was nervous, it was shaking.
Were you not shaking?
I tell you what, I focused on his balaclava.
Right.
And it was green, and it was two plain, two pearl. And wasn't there a mistake in it halfway up?
No.
There was two pearl on top of two plain, and two plain on top of two pearl. So I said, whoever knit that...
Mary, please stop. Will you stop, Mary? You have me on. It's Funny Friday tomorrow. You're saying there's a fella jumps over your counter in the bank.
Yeah.
Another one fella with a shotgun, one fella with a hatchet.
Now, the fellow with the shotgun was down the other end.
Okay, but he's still in the shop. You saw him. He jumps over. He says, where is the effing safe?
That's right.
And you didn't actually say to him, listen, wherever you bought that balaclava, you should bring it back because whoever knitted it made a mess of it.
No, I just thought it wasn't professional.
Okay, well, maybe that's
my day.
Why?
Because I had to focus.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And anyway, we were all brought out for a meal. We locked up and we were shaken a bit and we all wanted brandies. And the manager said, no, you have to go back and balance. You can have the menu, but no drink. And
but hang on, much to these were two men, were they? One with the hatchet, one with the
man,
and then
one
wearing the balaclava that wasn't.
The fella that got over beside me was the balaclava with the shaky hand and the hatchet.
And how much did they rob?
Did they rob?
Yeah.
Everything was on a time thing.
Oh,
and it's only after that they got the big screens up.
Okay.
Because the two guys were literally fit as fiddles, fleas, you know, the way they scaled the counters.
Okay.
Anyway,
okay.
We couldn't eat our dinners. We got compensation. I got an ilfisk.
An infant vacuum came down. Okay.
And she had missed all the action and she never got any compensation. So we all divvied up between us a tenner here and a tenner there for poor, I won't say any names.
Yeah, well, okay.
Anyway, Joe, all's well that ends well.
And were the two, was the hatchet man with the misstitched balaclava and the shotgun fella down the other end, were they ever caught?
I think they were. They were. They were dubs, real dubs, fit. But the safe was on a timer.
And they didn't get out. And one of them was.
And the cashiers, every time they have over a 5,000 in their box, it's taken off.
I know,
to this
timer.
And so I think they just got, not buttons, maybe hundreds, you know.
Okay, but were they charged with robbery and crimes against fashion with his misstitched balaclava?
I have no idea. I was only there on release.
And Mary, did you ever jump overs, they called them? Did you ever have any other jump overs when you were in the bank?
No, that's the only, though they had, but I was never involved. I was only sent out there on relief.
Okay.
For a few
Minute.
Weeks.
Where was it again? I know you're ringing from Minute, are you? Where was it? Where did it happen, the robbery?
Will I say Clondalkin?
Yeah, of course. You've just said it. Yeah. You're fine. And what were you saying? I just thought your observation, because you focus on something. And by the way, are you a knitter?
I am an avid
knitter. And what did you just? And I'm not being pleased. I'm not being facetious. But just tell us again what you spotted in his balaclava.
It was a bottle green.
Yeah.
You know that army green.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And there were two plain, two pearl, rib stitch.
Yeah. I know.
Now you need plain on top of plain and pearl on top of pearl.
Okay.
All through the balaclava. But he had plain on pearl, a pearl on plain, on a few rows of it.
But
and that was, like, it sticks out.
That was a crime. That was a crime in itself. But Mary, you know, if that balaclava had been retrieved, if that balaclava had been retrieved with him, your evidence could have convicted him about spotting the missed stitches in the plain and pearl.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, it's unusual. Well,
it
spotted.
Is.
He may have been a good jumper, but he was a brutal knitter.
Yeah.
Whoever it was, wasn't professional.
And
Mary, to go back to the, how were you afterwards? How were all the staff afterwards?
Well, you see, I was only there.
I know, but okay. But how were you the following few days?
I was sort of grand.
Okay.
But some of them, it was maybe their third or fourth, and they were they had therapy or whatever afterwards.
Oh, did they? Okay.
But because I don't know, I'm a bit laid back, Joe.
Are you? Okay. Well, that's a good way to be. Seriously.
It doesn't. Is until later.
Okay. And are you still?
Anyway, Joe, I'm a granny and a great granny.
Oh, you're a great woman, Mary. Are you still knitting?
I am. Yes.
And what are you knitting at the moment? You're probably knitting. What have you got on the go at the moment?
I'm learning to crochet in Lucan, and I have a scarf.
Oh, lovely.
I'm crocheting a scarf.
And are you run off your feet knitting for the grandchildren? The great-grandchildren, sorry.
No.
Yeah, tell them to.
They're all better employed than I ever was.
So they don't need the
grandchildren.
The jumpers,
and that's it.
Okay. Yeah. And Mary, what age were you when you started? Because it's dying out, isn't it, knitting?
Knitting, yeah. I loved it. I used to stay up well after midnight when the kids were in school.
And would you be like
navy jumpers and their cardigans and things. And I was a bit obsessive. I had to give it up because the knitting was getting more attention than my husband. If you understand that.
I do,
Joe,
of course I do.
I would be bleary-eyed, do you know, from the knitting.
And how long, when you were doing a knitting marathon, how long, what's the longest period you ever sat knitting?
Oh, about 6 hours,
good
maybe.
God. And would you be listening to the radio or watching the telly or?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, so and you could go into your.
Into
the knitting zone.
Yeah, but if I was doing iron jumpers, I'd have to keep my wits about me, you know.
Because they're so intricate, the detail.
Yeah, they are.
And just to remind young people today, they're all getting in their cars now, or if they're lucky enough to get a lift home, or getting on the bus, or walking with their parents, maybe they're listening to this. They're all wearing little school uniform jumpers. How long would it take you to knit a school jumper, Mary, for, say, an 8-year-old, second class?
Well, you see, I wouldn't set out to.
No, but give me an idea. How long would it take you?
Would have a time limit.
I know.
It would depend on the mood.
Okay, well, you wouldn't do it in one sitting, would you, over 8 hours?
I do, It depends too on the age of the child.
I'm saying 8, Mary. You're being too pernickety with me now. Yeah.
Jumper. Depends on the thickness of the wool.
Okay.
The needles.
You're not helping me, Mary.
Do a chunky one.
Okay. Say a week, will you? Say a week. I want all the young people to squirm with shame that their mothers go out and buy them the jumpers and their fathers go out and buy them the jumpers and it would take you a week to knit a jumper. That's how...
It wouldn't take a week.
Okay,
no,
I knew
days,
it. Knew
maybe.
Well, okay, final question. You got an ilk fisk out of compensation you got for the bank robbery. Have you still got it?
I still have it.
I knew. Why did I know?
It's all wooden floors.
Okay.
Oh, it's an antique.
But Nilfas are very robust.
They are robust.
Very robust, yeah.
Anyone that wants it.
Okay. You'll be getting orders for Christmas jumpers for the toy show with Ryan Tuberty.
Oh, and listen.
Will you give
up? Okay. My husband, it's just as well. He's in Australia. He'll never hear about this, hopefully.
And why is he in Australia?
What?
Why is he in Australia?
He's gone to visit the grandchildren.
Brilliant. And why aren't you gone, Mary?
I suffer from COPD.
Ah, yeah, okay.
I was there last year.
Ah, okay.
and I couldn't take the heat and the light.
And when will he be back?
Tomorrow week.
Oh, thank God, he won't be listening. If we shoot back tomorrow week, he's not in the air now. He's on the way out. To Australia.
Out of Australia, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, Mary, you're great. And the COPD, the climate in Australia would do you...
Walking.
And what causes COPD? Is that just age or cigarettes?
If I could go around and tell people what I know.
I know.
Do you know what I mean?
I know.
My lungs are ruined.
Are they?
And my husband, purely, he's a singer and he's a robust chest and that's what saved him.
Mm.
And I have a robust one. Joe, I'm going before I say something.
Yeah, you're grand. Are you on, you're not on the oxygen or anything, are you?
No, not yet.
Okay, thank God. And would you have been smoking, Mary, finally, when you were knitting?
Oh, no, I'm not that ambidextrous.
Okay. Okay, well, that you're a tonic anyway. I hope that you can manage the COPD as best you can, Petal, because you sound
I'm
a fantastic woman. Okay.
I'm looking to set up a group in Maynooth. Anybody there that's listening, they'll know me.
Okay. Yeah, group of what type of group?
A group for exercise. They're all over in hospitals.
And what type of exercise? You can't do yoga if you're a Catholic now. Are you Catholic, Mary?
Oh.
Remember what the bishop said? You can't do yoga.
I am.
That rules out yoga, mindfulness, Reiki, acupuncture.
These are physical. They're not.
Yeah, of course they are.
The exercises.
So, Mary, finally, are you looking for a yoga group in Maynooth?
No. COPD.
Oh, a COPD group in Maynooth.
There's one in Ballyfermot.
Okay.
And it was brilliant, but the drive-in,
it's a long way, and traffic and everything.
And then by the time you get organised.
And the COPD support groups are brilliant.
Yeah,
brilliant.
In Maynooth.
Okay.
Set up one.
Okay. Well, Mary, mind yourself. Have you got your knitting near you at the moment?
No.
Okay. Well, well done. And you never came across those two gurriers again with the hatchet and the shotgun.
No, playing some pearls. Good luck.
Good luck, Mary.
Good night.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
I'm just talking to Mary McMahon there about the good old days and knitting and sitting up late at night. I was privileged to be involved with a documentary that's going out tonight called Father Delaney, Silent Witness. It's on at 10:15 after prime time on RT1 television. And it's this fascinating story of Father Jack Delaney, a Dublin priest, amateur filmmaker, captured all walks of Irish life in the days long before television, long before the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and then the 60s when TV arrived. And his archive was handed over by his family to the Irish Film Institute, and Tracy O'Connor has made a beautiful piece of work stitching together, to use Mary's narrative, stitching together, not dropping any stitches at all, the archive. And if you'd like programmes like Reeling in the Years and all that nostalgia stuff, you'll absolutely love Father Delaney, Silent Witness tonight at 10:15 on RT1 television. Now back to and Mary's situation was serious as well, though she's moved on, but Tony in Meath. Tony, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And it happened to you in 1997. What happened, Tony?
It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, on a Monday morning early. My wife and I were in one room and our daughter, 21, was in the other room. And the next thing, I heard a voice shouting at me and calling me, Morgan, get out of the bed, Morgan. Get out of the infant bed.
Okay, Tony, if you could hold your phone closer, or if you're moving around, stay still for a minute or two. That might help us. It's 1997. You're in bedroom asleep. And two men arrive in with a shotgun saying, get out of bed.
Two with a shotgun each, sawn off shotgun each.
Yeah.
And I my spectacles are on the sideboard, so I put them on to see. I couldn't see very well. I put them on, and here he is, pointing the shotgun at me. The other fellow's at the far side of the floor, on the right-hand side of the bed, with another son of shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
So he ordered me out of the bed. We have a long hall. It's a bungalow, long bungalow, single-story house. And he marched me down the hall. And as he marched me down the hall, I looked at him. He was taller than me, very fit fella. And he struck me with a shotgun in the side of the head. Good punch. He said, "Don't look at me," he said, "look at the ground."
Wow.
So he brought me down to the kitchen, which is a good bit down the corridor, and he spread-eagled me on the floor.
Good God.
And he put his knee into my chest, and he put the shotgun up again me, side of me, left-hand side of me head, round me ear. And he pulled his trigger, the two triggers, the double.
I don't believe you.
Yeah, now you understand, Joe, when someone puts a gun tight against your throat and pulls the trigger, it's like they hit you with a little hammer. Do you know what I mean? The reverberation of it. And then, of course, I didn't realise it at this stage. So the lad is above my office, rooting for some kind of whatever the look of the money, obviously, or Evan. They were accusing me of being an informer. And they seem to be on the line of dissonance now, in my opinion.
An informer, they were looking for money, but informer for who?
Informer against the organisation, whatever organisation. The cause is what he was saying. The cause. Yeah. We want money for the cause. So, when he pulled the shotgun twice, I heard him say, feck or something like that, some old bad word. He said to the other fella, throw me down some cartridges. These ones are damp, he said. They're not walking. Yeah. What's going on now? So I could hear something sliding down the hall. It's a maple floor, old-fashioned maple, hard, solid floor. I could hear something skittering. And the next he put the gun against me head and he put it real tight and pulled it once. I never moved. And he said, "You're a hard man, aren't you?" I never answered. He slashed me buttocks for the night. At this stage, I didn't until afterwards. He had my wife tied up like a basket, her legs and her hands tied behind her, her legs and her hands tied together. She's on her face, down in the bed. And Terry, my 21-year-old daughter, is in the next bedroom. She's tied up the same way. And then he starts said, Morgan, he was calling me Morgan all the time. I said, I'm not Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked in the press in the kitchen, and he sees a photograph of me. And he said, "This don't look like you." I said, "I have my glasses off at the moment. So there's spectacles on that particular photograph," says I. So the lad was pushing away. And then he was looking for money for the cause. 50,000. 50,000. 50,000, says I. "Are you joking me? You have a Merc outside the door," he said. "Don't tell me you haven't got money." I said, "That Merc," I said, "is what 4 or 5 year old. And says I borrowed, here am I paying my business to a trader. I borrowed the money from the bank to buy that car. I work hard, says I. Yeah. That's what I do." So anyway, he kept on about money, and he keeps saying, "We've got the wrong Mahon." He's just kind of a Monaghan accent. "We've got the wrong Mahon," he said. He said, "Heads will roll. And if not," he said, "give me a kick in the ribs. We'll be back, Mahon," he said. So the other fellow then got all excited above in the office. I have it, I heard him say. And say, "Jesus, what has he got now? What, a little briefcase door with all small checkbooks I used to use at the time, you know, business checkbooks."
Yeah.
And there was about maybe nearly full of them now because I was a good while in business. And we saw all these checks, we thought this fella's laundered money or something. You know what I mean?
And how much did they get off you for a finish?
I kept telling them the truth. I said, "All the money is in this house." I said, "It's 1,100 euro, and that's in my pocket, in my wallet over there, up in the room now." I said, "In the sideboard." I said, "We were going on holidays tomorrow and had a few pounds saved up. There's 1,100 pounds. And the next thing he said, "We want money for the cause." So I was a little bit shy, Joe, I must admit, at this stage, even though things were very savagely under pressure. I said, "If you want more money than that, well, you'll have to come back in tomorrow," because I'll have to go to the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked up the hall and I could hear him saying, "Come back in the morning. Come back tomorrow." I didn't know whether he thought I was in Egypt or whether I was being smart, but he didn't hit me at that stage.
Okay.
Then he took me up and he brought me into the sitting room. He stretched me out in the sitting room.
How long did this ordeal last for?
An hour and a half, thereabouts. They tore out all the phones.
And were they ever caught?
No, never got. Now, the guards were out. I had a phone in the car, Joe, But all of the phones they tore out, the landline, mobile, my mobile, the Dynas mobile.
Yeah, I know. And the Gardaí, like, they took it seriously, obviously. Did they believe they were, what do you call them, dissident IRA, whatever you want to call them?
They did. No, I told them it was my opinion that they were, because they had black boots on them. They had a kind of downpipe. You know the downpipe jeans veil tight?
Anyone could do that.
And they were shocking fit, though. And he came close to me to talk in my ear. And he was as close as if he could nearly kiss me. And I could smell his breath. He had no drink on him. He had no drink. I say.
And by the way, were you taken to hospital given that he slashed you?
No, it wasn't very bad. It didn't go deep, though.
Okay, you managed. Given that it's what we're talking about, how was the trauma after that ordeal? 2 hours.
Oh, for Christ's sake, no, you must be joking. We had no alarm in the house at all. The door to the conservatory was open. All they had to do was walk in the door and walk through the kitchen and walk up the hall into the bedroom. So since then, we have all sorts of security, as you can imagine.
Okay. Yeah.
But they were never caught. It was a horrific deal.
And how was your wife, as you said, it was tied up savagely?
She was a very resilient lady. She
Fair
kept
play.
Her cool. And Terry kept her cool, our daughter kept
your
her cool
okay.
too. But then in the end, he brought me in. I thought, this is the end. He brought me into the bedroom, kneeled down there at the end of the bed, he said. I said, oh, here we go. He's going to shoot me in the back of the head. So next thing, he said, don't you move from where you are. You don't move for a quarter of an hour, he said, because there'll be someone outside the door, and if you come out, you'll be shot. So then I heard something hitting the radiator in the room. I couldn't look, but I heard something hitting. Of course, when they were gone, I realised what it was. He took his floppy pants and stuck the 1100 over and threw the wallet against the radiator.
Yeah.
So I was able to...
Okay, Janie Mac. Okay. Tony, thanks indeed. That's Tony in County Meath. 51551, just coming up to 70 minutes at 3 o'clock. Back after this.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Philip Gaffney. Philip, your incident and when you became a victim of crime, what happened?
Basically, I had parked my car up on Stephen's Green, and what I did is I supply gift shops. So I was in Stephen's Green shopping centre with Kearney's gift shop, which is no longer there.
Okay.
So I'm walking back up to the through Stephen's Green, and I'm looking, and I see a bit of and I thought, probably doing drugs or something like that. And as I got closer, I seen this guy stepping out of the bushes with a sample case in his hand.
Right.
And I thought, oh, I have a sample case like that. And then as I got a bit closer, I looked out and I seen that my car was actually open. The window was smashed. There was a scissor sticking out of the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realised that's my sample case. So as I'm walking up, because there's a bit of a walk, there was about, say, 100 yards between me and the two guys. Well, it ended up there was three of them, but there's two of them standing there. And I'm thinking to myself, do I tackle them? Do I let it go? I'm doing martial arts since I was 10, so I can handle myself, so I wasn't concerned from that point of view.
Okay.
There was two things. I just bought a brand new suit while I was in London, and it was a Pierre Cardin suit, so it was a nice suit, but it was a little bit tight on me, so I couldn't move too well. And I also didn't want to get my suit damaged. But I was also thinking, I heard a story about one of the guys in the UK who was a security guy, and he had punched one of these drug addicts. But when he punched him, didn't he hit him in the mouth, and your man's teeth cut through his hand, and he got AIDS. So all this has got...
Are you sure about that story? If there's blood on blood, I know... Back in the day, but anyway, okay. So your man has your case. You realise it's yours. He takes off. You couldn't run because you had the new suit on you. So how did it end?
No, well, what happened was he was actually standing there waiting, talking to the other two guys that were in the bushes.
Okay.
So I went up behind him. I decided it's mine, and I'm taking it back. Right. So I went up. I caught him by the back of the head. Stuck my knee in his back. So I pulled him back by the hair. He had the case in his right hand, so I was able to take the case off him. I said, give me that, that's mine. And he just looks at me and goes, rest your gears in the bushes, man. And I turned around and this guy stepped out, and he was a little bit taller than me.
Yeah.
So I ran at him, And he had a box in his hand, so he dropped the box and he ran. And then the other guy was on the ground rooting through stuff. And then he said, so they all ran off. I'm standing there with me stuff. And people then decided, oh, can we help you? And I'm like, well, you could have done something. I couldn't have done something, stopped them actually robbing me car. But what I found interesting was the guy took one of these boxes, and what was in the box was a leprechaun. So they thought it was actually a doctor's case.
Because it looked like a doctor's that case. Boxy case, yeah.
Yeah, so it looked like, and it was on the back seat, it was a Toyota Corolla car. So your man had actually smashed the window, there was blood coming down his head, because obviously he cut himself when he was reaching in to take the case off the back seat. Because I'd been in a shop in Powers Court a couple of weeks before then, and he had done a jump over, which is where he had jumped over the counter, grabbed what he thought was a money bag and ran out. And the security had caught him. The police came along, arrested him, said like he was known to them, he had drug issues. And so I'm looking at this thinking, it's only, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks after that, he's in Stephen's Green robbing my car.
Okay. Did he ever get convicted? Do you know, Philip?
No, not that I know of. No, because it's like they're saying, you know, it's one of a number of charges that they would have had against them. These three, because I spoke to the guards about it. Now, obviously, they were gone, and I couldn't identify. You know, I could say, well, I knew it was that guy.
Okay.
And they were like, yeah, well, we didn't catch him. We didn't catch him with the goods. We didn't catch him with this. You know.
But as you say, there was a number of previous incidents. Okay, Philip Gaffney in Dublin. 51551 joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at RT.ie. Peter Larkin, it's 1974. You worked in the bank. What happened?
Hiya, Joe. I worked in a bank in Dawson Street. Can I mention that bank's name?
Of course you can, yes. Yeah.
It's a crowd called Julian S. Hodge and Company Limited. Oh. They were kind of, I think they'd head office in Wales. But anyway.
Okay. In Dawson Street in Dublin.
In Dawson Street in Dublin.
Okay.
So we used to take in a lot of money in deposits and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And every afternoon, I would, the money would be put in a bag, you know, leather holder. And I'd head off down to AIV in Dale Street to lodge the money.
Right.
And on one occasion, I walked out of the bank.
How much money would you have been carrying on average?
Well, it could vary, Joe, from day to day. You know,
that's what I mean, but how much on average?
On average, maybe 5,000, 6,000.
Wow. And cash?
No, cheques. It could be cheques and cash.
Yeah, well, it's 1974. Okay, cheques were easily cashable. Yeah, okay.
3 to 4 grand, you know.
So here we go. So you're walking from, it's a relatively short journey from Dawson Street to Dame Street.
Yeah, and I walked across the road to get onto one of the side streets leading into Grafton Street. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of walking along there, and to my right there was a kind of a laneway, I can't think of it, but as I passed the laneway I felt as if someone had actually really bumped into me very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of staggered, and then the next thing I was grabbed and I was pulled down this lane, and realised then what was happening. There was a fella standing in front of me. Mm-hmm. Another guy maybe behind me or to the side of me, whatever. So I still had the bag in my hand.
Okay.
And at this stage then, I kind of said, right, your man in front of me now is going to get a haymaker. So I dropped the bag to give him, you know, to really let fly at your man. And so no sooner had I dropped the bag than all of a sudden everyone was gone. I was sort of standing there on my own. And I looked to my left and saw the guy who'd had been in front of me but had taken the bag. And he was just not very far away. He'd run across the road. Kind of a narrow street, as I can't remember the name of the street. Mm. But he was hopping up in the back of a little Honda 50. One of his colleagues had been waiting.
Yeah, get away, yeah. Did they get the bag?
Oh, they had the bag.
The man had the bag. Okay.
So he was on the back of the bike. So your man was trying to kickstart the bike. So I said, right. And I took off across the road, sort of rugby tackled him off the back of the bike. And he lost his balance.
Yeah.
He dropped the bag. I sort of fell on the ground, stood up, and he was as close to me now as he was only feet away. And I decided I was going to, you know, have a go, But I saw the bag on the ground, so I said, enough's enough. I'll just get the bag and go home. I'll go back to the office. So that was it. They took off, and then walking back to the office, then I realised I was bleeding. And, the result of the bang was 6 stitches in my head.
And you had, you defeated them. They stole the bag, but you actually retrieved it. You ran after them and got it back.
Well, I got it back.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I presume the bank promoted you to head of everything.
No, they did not, Joe. Nothing like that at all. I was a lucky man, a very, very lucky man, because.
And were you not just tempted to drop the bag?
How do you mean? Well, like, I did drop the bag, you see.
Yeah, but my point is, Peter, you're walking along Dublin Street, it's 1974, up to 5,000 in a bag from one bank to another. You're walking along the street, but you're on your own. The bank didn't say, well, always walk, two people walk together or get a taxi round so you don't have to be walking on the street. But you held on to the bag. And you got up, so you held on, then you got it back.
Yeah.
Did they give you a little reward? Didn't give you a hoover like Mary got, no.
No, no, I didn't get over, Joe, no.
Did you get anything? You get a bar of Cadbury's Dairy Milk or a Crunchy?
No, actually, I don't mind saying Sir Julian Hodge, who was the owner of the chairman, the founder of the bank, he sent me a few bob.
Oh, did he? Okay. Fair play, Julian.
You know, so...
Okay. You didn't hesitate when you rugby tackled your man off the back of the motorbike?
I obviously was a bit dazed with the blow, you know, but not realising at this stage I had been hit. And I kind of stopped for a second stupidly to see if there was traffic coming, and then the next thing I tore across and hit him. But apparently some gentleman in the car had seen this or whatever and actually tried to follow your man on the motorcycle and lost him. And ironically, from what I can gather, the Honda 50 was stolen from some young lad who worked on an AIB in Dana Street.
Okay. Peter, well done. The only other story like that I remember was Terry Wogan, when he worked in his wonderful autobiography, late Terry Wogan, when he worked in, was it the Munster and Leinster Bank at the Hanlon's Corner there? No, up in Hanlon's Corner in Fisborough. It's now Loretto's Restaurant. And the safe is still there, believe it or not. But he used to get the bus every afternoon with the bag of money, and get the whatever bus it was, the 19 or the 19A, into the Bank of Ireland. It was the Bank of Ireland, into the Bank of Ireland in College Green. He did the same thing as you did, except he recalls he'd be sitting upstairs in the bus with his bag on his lap with thousands of pounds sterling, as it was in those days. Anyway, Peter, thanks a million. Where is Gabriel? Gabriel.
Yes, hello. What
happened, Gabriel?
Well, I think it was probably in the 80s, but okay. I went into a bank in Baggot Street, the bit of Baggot Street that's nearest Merrion Square. Sorry, St. Stephen's Green, I should say, that area. And I went in, I was at the counter. In those days, there were long, straight counters, and all the people behind the staff behind the counter stood along the counter, and each had a person in front of them. And there wasn't this politeness of long queues like now, but you stood beside people. There were no boxed or glass features, or anything, just a straight, plain counter. So I was talking to my person, and she went up behind to copy something or other. Next thing I saw, the girl nearly opposite me, who was dealing with my neighbouring customer, and the staff member, burst into tears, absolutely burst into tears, as if she suddenly heard her mother had died or something. And I couldn't understand how this could happen. And they all came around, the staff came around, put their arms around, said, you know, because... So eventually, when I got a bit of a moment, I said to the staff member, what on earth's wrong with that poor girl? What's happened? Well, I said, did you not see it? And to the left hand, that was on the right hand side of me, on the left hand side of me, apparently, a man had come in the door, pointed a gun, standing right beside me, had pointed a gun at the member of staff, like next to my member of staff, opposite him, and demanded money, and presumably he got it, I didn't even say, and eventually he went out, and it was amazing, because I did not see anything.
It was over in seconds.
I didn't see or feel a thing, and he was able to do that casually, calmly, and quietly, and she was the person, obviously, right next to the person I was dealing with, and that's why she burst into tears, because he'd just gone out the door, and I've realised now how important those doors, those staggered doors, when you can't just walk out anymore, you know, you've got to wait for one door to open, and one door to close.
Well, he got away anyway, that was back in the 80s, as you say.
Thanks. But isn't that amazing that I had absolutely no sensation? And eventually asked me, would I give police games, or would I give a statement?
I'm happy to, I saw nothing.
But there won't be anything in it, because I saw nothing.
Okay. Gabriel, thanks indeed. Tommy Roach in Wicklow. Tommy.
Yeah, how are you doing, Joe?
Yeah, go ahead. What happened?
I was held at gunpoint in the AIB bank in Dunlavin some years ago. I'll be back in the late 80s as well, like, you know.
In Wicklow, yeah, okay. And many raiders?
There was two of them in it. One lad had the gun on my shoulder at the butt of my neck.
Yeah.
And the other lad was in across the counter before counters were upgraded, you know.
Oh, they grabbed you?
He grabbed me and he said, "This man is dead if you don't give over the money," like, you know.
Wow.
And the only worry I had was his hand was vibrating on the gun, and I was nervous that the gun might have a hair trigger.
Yeah.
You know what a hair trigger is?
Yeah, that'd fly.
Very fine, lets it off, like, you know.
Now, were you... See, this is where this discussion began with the Italian tourist held up at gunpoint outside the Guinness storehouse on Monday evening at 6:15. You heard of here on Liveline at 1:45 on Tuesday, first. But... Did you say to yourself, "I wonder, is this a real gun or a dummy gun?"
No, I wasn't. I knew. I didn't think. I thought it was a real gun. I stood very still. Like, but the unfortunate part of it was my son was with me in the bank, yeah. And I had just been served. I had just cashed the check, and I had money in my pocket. Like, and mm-hmm. I was afraid they'd get me to empty the pocket. So while I was there, I peeled off a 20-euro note off the roll of money I changed and yeah. ready to give it to him. But my son, who was studying for the Leaving Cert, actually, the Leaving Cert was coming up in a couple of weeks' time.
Okay.
And he failed it, actually. He should have flew through it, but he done it the following year and got it with flying colours.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
But you reckon the trauma...
Oh, yeah, he was...
And were the Raiders ever caught?
They were caught, actually.
Could you identify them in a parade? And you did identify them?
I did, yeah.
Well done. And did you go to court?
No, I didn't have to go to court. He was locked up anyway,
guilty or whatever, okay.
But I heard after he had, somewhere in the south of Dublin, they had a fantastic house, no income, and they had a billiard room and a lounge and I don't know what not in
little,
the house.
Little
you know,
has changed, little has changed.
And no income into the house, okay. Like I heard after, you know.
Okay. Tommy, thanks. I'm glad your son worked out all well for him in the end, exam-wise. Thanks indeed. There's Tommy Roach. We're back tomorrow in Faith Leg House Hotel for Funny Friday. Join me tonight at 10:15 on RT Radio 1 Television for Silent Witness, the Father Jack Delaney documentary. And Ray Darcy is next.